The 19th century, that is, the 1800s, represents a period of significant transformation for the practice of medicine, the general appreciation of the health sciences on the part of the population in the Western world, and thus the groundwork for very substantive changes in the area of bioethics. And in particular, what we will see is that as scientific advances begin to be incorporated into the practice of medicine, the public finds its way to trusting medicine more completely, and eventually there will be a substantial shift from patient autonomy, that is, patients calling the shots, determining whether or not to cooperate with medical care at the beginning of the century, to a kind of increasing notion of you can and must trust your physician. Medicine will always have your best interests at heart. Medicine is scientifically based and therefore going to provide a way forward for humankind at the end of the century and the beginning of the 20th century. This is a dramatic and radical shift, almost an about-face, and we need to be aware of what comprised it and out of what it was out of which it grew. We'll begin with the areas of anesthesia on the one hand and infectious disease and antisepsis on the other, because these represent two substantial advances that enable medicine to make very significant changes and to become a discipline of which people are no longer terribly afraid, primarily because of the reality of pain associated with medical procedures. If we look first at number one, anesthesia, we've already highlighted the fact that there was really no significant anesthesia up till the 19th century, up till the 1800s. There was the use of opium, sometimes combined with alcohol, but this was very dangerous, and it wasn't complete. The fundamental problem that one faces is that if you are going to render a person truly insensible, truly incapable of experiencing pain, then they need to be unconscious. And unconsciousness is perilously close in terms of the drugs that are used, whether administered by inhalation or injection or taken orally. Pretty much the anesthetic medications all have a similar effect. There is initially a period of excitation where the person is kind of excited and sort of happy-go-lucky. This is true whether one's talking about the use of ether or nitrous oxide or alcohol. And then there is gradually the progression to a period of less sensibility to pain and finally unconsciousness. But the problem is the margin between unconsciousness and the amount of drug that will actually stop breathing can be fairly narrow for some of these medications. And particularly if you're taking them by mouth and have a lot of it in your stomach that hasn't yet been absorbed, the danger is that a person may be unconscious, but there's still enough of the drug waiting to be absorbed that will push them to the point of not being able to breathe well. So one can understand that even when there were agents available, it was extremely dangerous, and the danger of death as a result of the use of these compounds earlier would always have been present. It was the development of medications that could be used by inhalation that really promoted the possibility of true anesthesia, because these agents could be stopped simply by removing the device that was being used to give the anesthetic gas or compound to the individual and having them breathe air. And then the amount of drug in their bloodstream would begin to diminish very significantly right away, again, as contrasted with something that might be given by mouth and might sit in the digestive tract and take a long time to be absorbed. Of course, later there will be the development of short-acting injectable anesthetics and discovery little by little of medications that can enable one to bypass the excitation period by sending the person to sleep rather more quickly. All of that is just to let one know why it was so difficult to have any form of general anesthesia prior to the discovery of the anesthetic gases in the 19th century. Now, our ability to appreciate exactly what this means is very, very vividly illustrated by a 19th century journalist and author who was popularly known as Fanny Burney, and who wrote in one of her letters of her experience of undergoing a mastectomy in France. And this was, of course, just before the anesthetic era, and so the surgery was performed without any anesthesia at all. I will not read it out loud. It's very disturbing to try to linger over the phrases, but again, this gives you an insight into what it would have been like to have to submit to a procedure that took some time without the use of anesthesia. And this woman describes rather vividly what that entailed for her. And I'd invite you to read this on your own and again, reflect on what this meant in terms of the kind of ascetic endurance, the kind of willingness to endure pain for anyone willing to submit to surgery prior to relatively modern times. This very poignant and difficult description makes it clear what a real blessing anesthesia was. If we drop down to number 1.2, the blue bar that says nitrous oxide, ether, and chloroform, the beginnings of inhalation anesthesia were really the result of the applications of studies that had already begun to be done in universities and various institutions, including medical institutions, by people interested in the newly developing science of chemistry. And substances such as ether and then chloroform and nitrous oxide were known, were able to be compounded, were able to be created. And the intriguing thing is that in the 19th century, nitrous oxide was used in sideshows and carnivals as a form of entertainment. People would be induced to get up on stage, inhale nitrous oxide for a period of time, and then during the excitation phase, they would be willing to do all sorts of silly and ludicrous things. Well, a dentist named Horace Wells in the United States noticed in the early 1840s that at one of these performances, one of his fellow townsmen fell down and hurt his leg very substantially, very significantly during his performance under the influence of nitrous oxide, but appeared not to notice the pain at all, and indeed wasn't even aware that he had hurt himself until the effects of the gas began to wear off and he'd resumed his seat. So Wells, who was a compassionate man, realized that this might be something that could be used for people during dental extractions, and he began to use it himself in his own dental practice beginning in 1844. He attempted to recommend the use of nitrous oxide to the broader medical establishment. The difficulty is that although this is useful for dentistry, it is a bit more dangerous and difficult to induce real general anesthesia with nitrous oxide. There are problems with how much oxygen the person needs to get and a long excitation phase. So he attempted to have a public demonstration of how valuable this could be, and frankly, this public demonstration was a bit of a fiasco. The patient said it didn't hurt as much as they thought it would, but the surgeons who were gathered to watch and to see whether or not this could be something that could be used for real surgery other than simple dental extractions were not impressed and discounted it as a kind of a, quote, humbug, unquote. Well, a friend and former colleague named William Morton, also a dentist practitioner, although he had never really attained his degree, speaking to one of his professors, he was studying medicine as well, although there again he never completed his medical studies, asked about alternatives, and it seems likely that ether was recommended to him as something he ought to investigate. And after his own efforts, he was able to convince a number of surgeons in Boston to allow him to attempt a public demonstration of ether anesthesia, and that's what you see in the picture, the famous picture that's depicted there, and that is the first use of ether anesthesia for the removal of a neck tumor, and on this occasion, the patient was insensible, was asleep, and the surgeons were very profoundly impressed because, of course, there had never been in their experience anything like that kind of surgery that did not involve tremendous screaming, agony, and physically holding down the patient. So this was something entirely new and extremely impressive. As I mentioned in the text, shortly thereafter, the practice was taken up in Great Britain, and James Simpson in 1847 introduced chloroform for use in obstetrics, and so these became the standards, ether and chloroform, and nitrous oxide continued to be used and is even used today in dentistry. I might mention parenthetically that these early pioneers, Wells and Morton, did not lead happy lives. Poor Wells became convinced that he was terribly humiliated by the lack of success at his initial attempt to encourage people to use anesthesia. He was probably rather jealous of his former colleague Morton, who had been more successful, and so he attempted to find various agents. He eventually used ether himself and became addicted to the inhalation of ether. He also became psychologically impaired and had an episode where he basically became insane, ran crazy through the town, attacked a couple of prostitutes, in fact assaulted them by apparently throwing sulfuric acid at them. And later, when he came out of his ether-induced haze and craze, realized what he had done and committed suicide using ether as a means of numbing the pain of opening an artery. So this poor man, this poor compassionate initiator of the use of anesthesia in the U.S. Ended life very tragically. Morton similarly ran into trouble because he wanted to claim the right to even patent the use of ether and therefore claim a financial right when this was used. As you can imagine, it's widespread used throughout the world, resisted any attempt at patenting, and he ended up spending his latter years rather sadly trying to claim preeminence in the use of anesthesia, and ended life a very unhappy individual as well. As we shall see, the story of the misunderstood medical pioneer of the 19th century becomes a story that is repeated with tragic frequency. Let's move down to number 2, infectious disease and antisepsis. The ability to deal with infections, although, as we'll see, without really understanding or recognizing the reason why certain approaches worked, which would await the application of science to biology and medicine by such geniuses as Louis Pasteur, who, by the way, was not a physician, but actually was a chemist. The ability to deal with or do something substantial about infections was actually something that precedes the 19th century. The practice of vaccination is primarily associated with Edward Jenner, a physician in England who lived at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. What was unique in his recommendation? It was a modification of an existing practice. What was done prior to this time was inoculation rather than vaccination, inoculation with the disease itself. And so there was a practice that had been imported from the Far East of deliberately exposing people to or infecting them with material taken from a wound of a person who had the disease smallpox, giving the person the disease in what was hoped to be a mild form when the person was healthy, hoping that they would do well and then acquire the immunity that follows certain infections, especially infections with certain viruses. So it was known that inoculating a person with smallpox, if they did well and survived, as hopefully they would work well. This is not what Jenner did. That practice was centuries old. What Jenner did was to notice that women in particular who worked with cows and who acquired a disease similar to smallpox but much more mild, much less frequently involved in the dangerous complications of scarring and even of death that accompanied smallpox, Jenner noticed that women who were infected with cowpox, who acquired this from their work as dairymaids, were mysteriously resistant to smallpox. Jenner thus observed that the being infected with a disease very similar to another disease could confer immunity, and he was right, because what these women had acquired in the disease cowpox was a viral infection by a virus very similar to the smallpox virus, which conferred immunity, that is, it triggered an immune response in the person who had that disease that allowed them to combat smallpox. So Jenner took material from those who had suffered from cowpox and then deliberately infected individuals. There's a famous picture of Jenner vaccinating a young man named James Phipps. And intriguingly, the cow that was used was the original source of the material of the infection. Was a particular cow named Blossom, and Jenner is shown with a picture of this famous cow there on the left. Jenner deliberately inoculated young James Phipps in 1796. That is to say, he vaccinated him. And vaccination literally means, because it includes the Latin word that means cow, that is, you are being deliberately inoculated with material taken from a cow. And that is thought to, and was accurately, correctly believed to, confer immunity from the terrible scourge of smallpox, which could be a deadly disease. The reason for this immunity was not understood, although the idea of a disease, one disease conferring immunity to later infections, or a disease conferring immunity to similar diseases, was something that had been observed and was considered to be analogous to the development of resistance to certain kinds of poisons that was known to be true, particularly arsenic and related compounds, in which repeated small doses could confer an immunity to, or that is, the ability to withstand exposure to larger amounts of the compound that might kill another person. This observation that had been present since ancient times was thought to be somehow related to the immunity that was being conferred with vaccination. The idea that there would be a very small microorganism, in fact a virus, that was causing this illness would not be known for another century. But it was generally observed that this worked, and the practice of vaccination, that is, of deliberate infection with cowpox, became widespread, and through its widespread application and modification in modern times, has resulted in the actual eradication of smallpox from the world. The only smallpox that exists at present is in flasks in a few laboratories in very specific parts of the world. So we find in Jenner someone who, without knowing the reason why, was able to engage in a practice that actually did prevent infection from a particular microorganism, the virus that causes smallpox. If we now move to number 1.2, Ignaz Semmelweis, what we find is a pioneer who also did not understand the reason why his observations bore fruit, but who, without knowing the reason why, began to introduce patterns that would become quite normative later on. Semmelweis was a physician in training and was in charge of supervision at the obstetrical clinic at the University of Vienna, and he noticed that the different wards had different rates of puerperal sepsis, of childbirth or childbed fever, which is the infection of the mother, usually with a streptococcus or staphylococcus, but usually streptococcus, that can result in, certainly in those days, in terrible infection and in the death of the mother. He noticed that there were radically different rates or levels of infection in different wards, and he discovered that the ward that had the highest rate of this terrible scourge was the ward in which the students would come to deliver babies after waiting while the woman was in labor. They would wait for that in the dissecting labs, in the morgue, where they would be engaging in the dissection of corpses, and they would come to deliver babies directly from having their hands obviously very contaminated material. Semmelweis, didn't know about germ theory, but he did know that these young men had their hands in some rather rank and stinking materials, and he began to suspect that it was the transmission of something like that to these poor women that was causing their death. So he eventually chose water which was laced with chlorine water, rather like modern bleach, and insisted that the students on his ward simply wash their hands in chlorine water before attempting to deliver babies. And the rate of puerperal sepsis dropped precipitously. He was able to document that this was life-saving, that it was tremendously beneficial, without knowing exactly why, without being able to say what it was that was being transmitted to the women, but it was clear that it was being transmitted on the unwashed hands of these student doctors. The response of the medical community was basically to deride and criticize Semmelweis for what was perceived as his accusation that physicians' unclean hands could actually have anything to do with the cause of disease. This outraged his professional colleagues. He was denied promotion, eventually had to move to Budapest, where he again found himself in charge of an obstetrical clinic, where he again insisted on the precaution of washing hands before delivering babies. Once more, he was able to document very clearly that this resulted in fewer deaths on the parts of the women whose babies had been delivered, and once again, the medical community was outraged. The faculty at Vienna had influence, because this was the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, had influence in Budapest. He was again persecuted by his medical colleagues, and as he began lobbying, writing letters, claiming that the failure to wash one's hands in this way was a kind of an act of murder, that it was not taking care of patients properly. Again, his colleagues reacted in rage, and the controversy and a number of other factors literally drove him insane. He died 2 weeks after being involuntarily committed to a mental institution in Vienna, and it seems likely that that it was a result of beatings that he received when he attempted to leave, because he had not realized that he was being committed to that institution when he was let in by someone who he thought was his friend. I had the opportunity to study at the University of Vienna, and I was astonished at what I would claim is the blatant hypocrisy of the institution to have in this aula, in this walkway, this courtyard of the university, busts and bas-reliefs of famous, revered teachers who have attended or taught at the University of Vienna. And these include Semmelweis and Freud. Freud was hardly given an easy time of it, but Semmelweis, again, was literally persecuted by his colleagues, and the idea that the institution would quietly or passively claim some credit for his genius is really quite astonishing and remarkable. Well, Semmelweis's convictions and some of his results were known in other countries, but often they were misunderstood. The developing science of microbiology, the slow dawning awareness that perhaps the microorganisms that had been observed in microscopes for centuries might have something to do with disease, was beginning to click in certain people's minds. And this brings us to Joseph Lister, the famous physician and surgeon in England and in Scotland, who really introduced antiseptic surgery in the year 1867. Lister's story was that as a young practitioner of medicine in the north, he was appalled by the number of terrible injuries that were being received in the increasingly industrialized machinery of the results of the Industrial Revolution, and compound fractures were always infected. That is, a fracture in which the bone protrudes through the skin, and very often, if not always, resulted in amputation. He noticed simply that compound fractures, as they become infected, give off an unpleasant odor, and he noted that in the region where he was practicing medicine, waste or sewage was being treated with phenol or carbolic acid as a way of rendering the stench less prominent, and then it became less problematic. And he wondered if this agent, which was used in sewage treatment, might not be used medically. So he tried the experiment of creating a carbolic acid, a mild carbolic acid dressing, and applying it to the wound of someone who had a compound fracture, and astonishingly, he discovered that the wound did not become infected, and the individual was able to keep his leg. So Lister became convinced that there was some agent that was being transferred to the wound by either the hands of the physician or the clothing that the person wore, or just their being in a dirty environment, or perhaps even from the air itself, although that wasn't widely believed, that needed to be dealt with. And so Lister initially experimented with a variety of carbolic acid dressings, which continued to be used, and finally conceived the idea that you could spray a fine mist of carbolic acid over a surgical field and thus prevent the infection and the inflammation, which he began progressively to believe was being caused by microorganisms. He was reading the results of other scientists' work, and Pasteur's work was becoming more widely known. And so this idea of a sprayer which would antiseptically cleanse or prevent the infection of the surgical wound and the surgical instruments was his primary contribution. And these sprayers became extremely common throughout England and Europe. And so now one began to have the combined blessings of surgery that could be done without causing pain and surgery that would eventually not result in horrific life-threatening infections. So it now became possible to perform surgery on parts of the body, regions of the body that previously were so dangerous to open that you knew the patient would always die. Abdominal surgery, chest surgery, brain surgery became progressively more possible, and advances in all of these fields followed. Now, the limitation of Lister's approach was that this is antiseptic surgery, that is, you use something to kill off the microorganisms. He did not accept until very late in life the recommendations of the genius Louis Pasteur, who suggested you don't really have to spray something to kill the organisms. If you keep your hands clean and your garments clean and everything that touches the patient is aseptic, that is, not containing things that will kill the organism, but absolutely free of any organism contamination, that is to say that they've been sterilized. The idea of sterilizing instruments, of wearing surgical gowns that have themselves been sterilized, and maintaining a sterile environment was a development that Lister actually resisted until later in life, when he realized that this suggestion was actually much more practical, and there were in fact complications of spraying carbolic acid all over the wound. And in fact, the practice of surgeons who were using these carbolic acid sprayers was to simply wear a frock coat, often liberally coated with the blood of their last patient. So the application of Semmelweis's idea of cleansing the hands that would touch the wound itself, and then eventually the clothing and cloth surrounding the patient, together with the observation that you do need to kill off organisms, would make the real progress of antisepsis complete. And one of the great pioneers, if we drop down to number four, was Louis Pasteur, an incredibly brilliant scientist, a biologist and chemist. His real work initially was in crystallography. He was fascinated by crystals. And without going into the details of what he observed, he eventually was asked by his government to try to understand the reason why various diseases were afflicting crops and then eventually farm animals. And he became convinced that the microorganisms that could be seen in the laboratory through the microscope were responsible for disease. He demonstrated it, engaged in several famous experiments that proved that there was no spontaneous generation of creatures, that actually creatures come from pre-existing cells, and that the bacteria and molds that are responsible for what would would then have been termed corruption actually float in the air. And he created a series of flasks and a series of experiments that demonstrated this, and which could be repeated, the beginnings of the application of the scientific method, that is, an observation that can actually be repeated in another laboratory by using the same conditions that the original experimenter had employed. Pasteur was able to demonstrate the truth of his findings, although he met tremendous resistance from his professional colleagues. And again, many of them would remind him that he was not a physician himself, but his contributions to medicine were phenomenal. He developed immunizations for chickenpox, for cholera, diphtheria, anthrax, and then rabies in 1876, which was a tremendous contribution because rabies was almost uniformly fatal in his day. As I've noted, however, at the end, his recommendation that surgical instruments could be boiled, that is to say that aseptic surgery could be undertaken, was resisted by the medical establishment really until the early 20th century. And it's just a reminder that if you've been taught in a particular way, that this is the way you're supposed to do things, it is often very difficult to change, and you very often opt for the science or the explanations that ratify and reaffirm you in your own way of thinking.